Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're looking at, well, a pretty fascinating figure through the lens of a really comprehensive biography, Kurt Anderson.
Yeah, it's quite the source material.
It really is. And our mission really is to understand how one person manages to be, you know, so many things, founder of a legendary satirical magazine.
Right, spy.
Then a Peabody-winning radio host, and then pivots again to become this, like, serious historian of American belief, or maybe delusion.
It's an incredible range, isn't it? And it kind of forces you to ask, well, what is the best way to analyze America? Is it satire? Is it literature? Is it straight up history?
Exactly. We're talking about Kurt B. Anderson, born 1954, American writer, novelist, nonfiction author.
TV writer, playwright, editor, radio host, podcast host. I mean, the list just goes on.
It's that sheer breadth that's so striking. Most people find a lane, right? He seems to have driven comfortably in about five different ones.
Uh-huh.
And probably the most recognizable thing for a lot of listeners, the real nugget, is that he co-created and hosted Studio 360.
Yeah, Peabody award-winning show, yeah.
For 20 years. I mean, that really anchored cultural discussion on public radio for ages.
It did. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating, I think, is how he shifts platforms, you know, from the really aggressive speed of print satire to the slower pace of long-form audio, but his core role, it stays the same.
Which is?
He's always the critical analyst of the American system, you could say.
Yeah.
His ability to just slide between, like, highbrow criticism, think The New Yorker.
Yeah.
And then that really sharp, targeted satire of Spy magazine.
That's the key.
I think it is. It's the key to understanding his influence. He uses humor, sure, but it's always backed by just painstaking research. It makes his points really hard to just dismiss.
Okay, so let's unpack where that sharp, analytical approach came from. He was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1954. Graduated from Westside High School.
Right. So Midwestern roots.
Which maybe sets him up for that mix. Right. You know, a bit of Midwestern skepticism combined with that East Coast intellectual thing he picked up later.
Could be. Because he went to Harvard College. And that's really where he sharpened his tools, so to speak.
Editor and vice president of the Harvard Lampoon, graduated magna cum laude.
Yeah. The Lampoon is basically a factory, isn't it? For combining literary skill with that critical, often really savage humor.
It trained him not just to, like, crack jokes, but how to build an argument, almost like a narrative attack through humor.
Exactly.
And before we get into Spy itself, there's this really interesting little biographical detail, almost a footnote. But looking back, it adds a strange layer, doesn't it?
You mean the Ginny Thomas connection?
Yeah. The sources mentioned that growing up in Omaha, he lived literally across the street from Ginny Thomas.
Who, of course, is now this major figure in conservative activism, married to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
It's just, wow, the guy who spends decades analyzing the roots of political division.
Lived across the street from someone who becomes a key player in those very divisions. It's like this accidental personal link to the national fault lines. He ends up dedicating so much work to dissecting.
Wild. Okay, so that intellectual curiosity, that satirical edge he honed at Harvard, it all comes together with the launch of Spy magazine in 1986.
Co-founded with E. Graydon Carter and Thomas L. Phillips Jr.
Can you just imagine the explosion that magazine caused in mid-80s New York? It wasn't just satire.
No, it felt like more like a cultural intervention or something.
Yeah, a correction.
It was pretty revolutionary because it changed the game for magazine journalism. It wasn't just poking fun. It was almost like committing journalism, but making it sting. Painfully accurate sometimes.
Dave Eggers said back in the mid-90s that Spy might have remade New York's cultural landscape. It definitely changed the whole tone of magazine journalism. That's huge praise.
It is. They really did move the needle on what you could say, how you could critique culture.
And what made it so potent, I think, was the method. It wasn't just cheap shots off the cuff.
No, no. It was the meticulous reporting. That's what gave it teeth. They deploy all this detailed research, but for maximum comic effect.
Like those tiny print box scores comparing celebrities' apartment sizes, or listing every single inflated honor some power player claimed.
Exactly. Things like that. It wasn't just funny in isolation. It was a kind of devastating takedown of all that 80s excess and pretension.
That combination, the rigor and the ridicule, that was the magic formula.
Yeah. Christopher Buckley, the novelist, he knew that scene well. He said in 2006 that Spy didn't capture the zeitgeist. It was the zeitgeist.
Mm-hmm.
High praise.
And he also pointed out who hated it.
Right. He said it was despised by all the right people, and prime among them.
It's Donald Trump.
The developer who, you know, later became president.
Which naturally brings us to probably the most enduring phrase, the lasting souvenir from the whole spy era.
The epithet.
Coined by Anderson and Carter in 1988 for Trump.
Short-fingered vulgarian Donald Trump.
It's just perfect satire, isn't it? It's so precise.
Totally. It targets the ego, obviously, but it's layered. It's not just calling him names.
No, it's an indictment of taste, of wealth, of insecurity.
All in three words. Exactly. It shows how the simplest, most visual detail, the short fingers, can anchor this really complex critique of character.
Kevin M. Lerner, a journalism professor, summed it up well in 2017. He said Spy basically invented the painstakingly reported but still funny satirical magazine feature.
And he stressed that key combination again. As funny as Mad and as well reported as The New Yorker.
That's the standard. That commitment to reporting, even in satire, feels like a direct line to Anderson's later historical work, doesn't it?
I think so. The methodology carries through, even if the tone changes.
So the Spy chapter, it does eventually close. The magazine gets sold in 91. Anderson leaves in 93.
Though it kind of lingered on until 98.
Right. But its cultural impact was just immense. So big, in fact, that Anderson co-wrote and co-produced two NBC specials based on it.
Yes. Yeah, Spy magazine presents How to Be Famous in 91.
Hosted by Jerry Seinfeld, no less.
And the Spy magazine hit list in 92, hosted by Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
I mean, think about that jump. From this niche, super smart, cutting satire magazine.
Straight to network television specials with huge comedy stars. That's massive crossover appeal. It shows how much Spy's attitude had permeated the culture. And, you know, by the time he actually left Spy, Anderson wasn't just the satire guy. He was already seen as a serious voice in cultural commentary and mainstream journalism.
Right. He'd been doing other things all along.
Even before Spy, he worked as a writer for Gene Shalit, you know, the Today Show critic.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that connection.
And maybe more significantly, he spent 9 years as the architecture and design critic for Time magazine.
That shows his range right there.
Yeah,
applying that critical thinking to everything from buildings to social trends.
Definitely. He wasn't just reviewing things. He was analyzing the underlying ideas.
And he kept that up. After Time and moving into the late 90s, he became a staff writer and columnist for The New Yorker. That was 96 to 99.
His column there was called The Culture Industry.
Which is such a perfect title for him, isn't it? It shows his interest wasn't just in the art itself, but the whole machine that creates and sells culture.
Exactly. Analyzing the mechanics. And he revisited that kind of urban commentary later with his column, The Imperial City, for New York Magazine from 2004 to 2008.
Okay, so all this experience, the satire, the criticism, the mainstream journalism, it kind of sets the stage for this really high profile, but ultimately short, run as editor-in-chief of New York Magazine.
Yeah, starting in 1994. And initially it looked like a huge success. The sources say circulation went up, ad revenue went up pretty quickly.
So he knew how to run the ship, commercially speaking, while also making the magazine buzzworthy?
He seemed to have that balance down. He invigorated the content, stabilized the business. It looked like a perfect fit.
But this is where the story takes a sharp turn. And it feels like a really pivotal experience for him, one that probably informed his later nonfiction, particularly Evil Geniuses.
Oh, definitely. His time as editor-in-chief was cut short. Just, what, 5 months later, 1996?
Not even 2 years. He started in 94, fired in 96 after about 18 months, I think. Still a very abrupt end.
Right, about a year and a half then. But the reason he was fired, that's the key part. It's become this sort of classic example of corporate interference in journalism from that time.
So let's unpack that specific incident. It's pretty illuminating.
Okay, so New York Magazine's publisher was controlled by KKR, the massive private equity firm. Headed by Henry Kravis.
One of the biggest names in finance.
Absolutely. And Kravis, according to the sources, directly intervened in the editorial side. He told Anderson to kill a story.
And what was the story about?
It was about this intense rivalry playing out inside the Lazard Investment Bank, specifically between two titans of finance, Felix Rohatyn and Steven Rattner, battling for control.
Exactly the kind of high-stakes, inside-baseball story about power and money that a magazine like New York should be covering.
You'd think so. But Kravis's demands apparently went further. It wasn't just about killing that one Lazard story.
He wanted Anderson to stop covering Wall Street entirely.
That's what the reporting suggests. Basically, an edict from the owner to steer clear of the financial world. Not because of journalistic merit, but seemingly to protect the interests of the financial industry itself, the world KKR operated in, and the role the magazine relied on for ads and access.
And Anderson? He pushed back.
He demurred, refused to kill the story, refused to agree to stop covering finance. He stood his ground on editorial independence.
And the result?
He was fired shortly after. It's just such a stark example of that structural conflict, right? When big money controls the media outlet that's supposed to be holding big money accountable.
It really puts a personal edge on the arguments he makes later in Evil Geniuses about how economic power works to protect itself using coordinated efforts. This was like a real-time lesson for him.
You have to imagine it solidified his skepticism about corporate power. But it didn't seem to slow him down much. He pivoted again, showing he was always looking at new formats.
Right into the early internet era. In 1999, he co-founded Inside,
which was an online news site focused on media and entertainment, but it also had a bi-weekly print magazine component right there at the start of that first dot-com boom.
He definitely saw where things were heading, but man, that era was volatile.
Totally. In 2001, Inside merged with Stephen Brill's site and magazine, which was doing similar stuff.
But then the combined company got snapped up by Primedia.
And Primedia.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't keep going long. They shut down the Brill site in October 2001, and then Inside followed soon after.
Ugh, a classic story from that boom and bust period for early digital media. Quick rise, quick fall.
Yeah, really illustrates the instability back then. But even with those setbacks, he kept innovating, kept trying new things.
Like his work with Barry Diller.
Exactly. From 2001 to 2004, he was a senior creative consultant at Diller's Universal Television. And he co-created Trio, that arts and entertainment channel.
And he kept exploring new ways to get curated content out there. Co-founded Very Shortlist in 2006.
Which was a daily email service for cultural recommendations. Again, linked up with Diller's IAC and involved former colleagues like Michael Jackson and Bonnie Siegler.
It just shows this constant searching, right? Always looking for the next platform, the next way to deliver smart, curated analysis to an audience. He doesn't seem to stop.
Yeah.
Okay, so while his print and digital ventures had all these like dramatic ups and downs, conflicts, big swings, his audio career tells a different story. Much more stability, sustained influence.
Yeah, we really have to spend some time on Studio 360, co-created and hosted from 1999 all the way to 2020.
20 years. That is an incredible run in public media, dedicated to smart, accessible arts and culture programming.
It's a phenomenal achievement. It was a co-production of PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC in New York.
Yeah.
Reached a huge national audience.
Broadcast on, what, 240 public radio stations across the U.S.?
Something like that, yeah. Over 500,000 weekly radio listeners, plus that growing podcast audience, especially in the 2010s, it really gave him this platform to mature his critical voice, deliver analysis in a more patient, thoughtful way.
And the quality was just consistently recognized. They won a Peabody Award in 2005.
For that amazing hour-long documentary they did on Herman Melville's Moby Dick.
Which says a lot, right? It wasn't just a general award for cultural coverage. It was for this incredibly deep, scholarly, but still totally engaging dive into one single massive work of American literature.
That Peabody really captures the show's whole approach, I think. It showed Studio 360 wasn't just, you know, reporting on what gallery opened or what band was cool.
It was using art as a way into history, into cultural understanding.
Exactly. They treated Moby Dick not just as a great novel, but as this lens to understand 19th century America, the ambition, the obsession with expansion, maybe even ecological anxieties.
That whole idea using a cultural icon to unpack national myths and beliefs, they formalized that, didn't they, in the American Icons series.
They did. Highly celebrated format. They produced 17 of these hour-long specials, each one focusing on a single cultural work or landmark.
Can you give us a couple of examples? How did they work?
Sure. Take their hour on the autobiography of Malcolm X. They didn't just review the book. They explored how its story of transformation shaped, and maybe sometimes complicated, the broader narrative of the civil rights movement.
Talking to historians, cultural figures.
Right, people directly influenced by it. Or think about their episode on Monticello, Jefferson's Home. They analyzed how Jefferson's specific architectural choices, pulling from European classicism, actually reflected his really conflicted ideas about democracy, slavery, the nation's future.
Reading the architecture like a text.
Pretty much. And the fact that they included places like Disneyland and EPOT, that's really telling, too.
Yeah, most art shows would just see those as theme parks, right? Entertainment.
But Anderson in this show saw them as like competing manifestos about American ideology, how we see ourselves.
So Disneyland as?
As this kind of perfected, nostalgic dream of an American past that maybe never quite existed. Consumable reality.
And EPCOT.
As the contrast. Walt Disney's original, much more radical vision of an experimental prototype community of tomorrow. This idea of a planned technological utopia.
So by putting those two Disney visions side by side, they weren't just talking about theme parks?
No, they were offering this really sharp analysis of American consumerism versus American technological idealism. That's Anderson's method in action, using culture, high or low, to get at the why behind our collective beliefs and assumptions.
Okay, so after Studio 360 wraps up in 2020, he doesn't exactly retire to a quiet life. He pivots again, but stays in audio for his next big project.
Bro, the Nixon at War podcast series in 2021, 7 episodes.
This felt like a major statement, a really serious historical undertaking.
It absolutely was.
Mm-hmm.
Applying that same rigor you see in his nonfiction writing, but using the intimacy and narrative power of audio.
And the source material was incredible, right? Hundreds of newly unearthed tapes.
Hmm. Yeah, archival recordings from both the Nixon and the Lyndon Johnson presidencies. So it wasn't just recounting history. It was immersing you, the listener, directly in the primary sources. Very much like the deep reporting of Spy, but aimed at the highest levels of political history.
And the core argument of Nixon at War ties directly into his bigger themes about America today, doesn't it?
It does. It connects the dots. The series explored how Nixon's specific choices and actions regarding the Vietnam War, particularly how he manipulated political divisions for his own gain, didn't just lead to his own downfall with Watergate.
But also laid groundwork for today's polarization.
Exactly. He argues it significantly contributed to the deep foundational polarization that we're still grappling with in the U.S. now. He's always tracing the current problems back to these specific historical turning points, these crucial decisions made decades ago. Now, before we really dig into those huge nonfiction books, Fantasyland and Evil Geniuses, we should definitely touch on the rest of his literary work, because his output is just so varied.
He's written quite a bit of fiction, too, serious novels.
He has. His first novel, Turn of the Century, came out in 1999. It was a sharp satire about media culture in the late 90s, right before the dot-com bubble burst. And it was a national bestseller.
Then he shifted gears completely for his next one, Heyday, in 2007. That was historical fiction.
Yes, set in the mid-19th century. And it won the Langham Prize for American Historical Fiction, which is a pretty big deal in that genre.
And then True Believers in 2012, another novel dealing with media, politics, memory. That got great reviews, too. Named one of the year's best novels by several places.
So it shows he can move between contemporary satire and really serious literary exploration in his fiction, just like he does in his nonfiction and journalism.
We should also probably mention his earlier humor writing, stuff that even predates Spy.
Right, like The Real Thing from 1980. It was about quintessentialism, this funny idea about people trying to find the absolute perfect, most essential version of everything.
You can see that early interest in puncturing pretension, right? Analyzing why people idealize things.
Definitely. And Tools of Power, also from 1980, was a direct parody of all those self-help and corporate success books that were starting to blow up back then.
And he kept that collaborative satirical spirit going, too, like Loose Lips in 1995.
Which was based on edited transcripts of real conversations, often kind of dumb or funny ones, and he turned that into an off-Broadway play.
But the biggest commercial hit, in terms of recent satire, has to be that collaboration with Alec Baldwin in 2017.
Oh, yeah. You Can't Spell America Without Me. The really tremendous inside story of my fantastic first year as president.
The fictional memoir by Donald Trump.
Co-written by Anderson and Baldwin. Huge New York Times bestseller. It showed that the old spy energy and insight could still land a massive punch, especially aimed at that particular target.
Okay, but let's really get into what feels like the intellectual core of his later career. The two big companion volumes of cultural and political history. These books feel like a synthesis of everything he's been observing for decades.
They really do. They lay out these grand structural arguments about America. Let's start with the first one, Fantasyland. How America Went Haywire. A 500-year history, published in 2017.
Just the title alone, Fantasyland. And the scope, 500 years, it's ambitious, to say the least.
It's breathtaking, really. He goes all the way back to the very first European ideas about the continent. And the book's central aim is to explain what he sees as America's peculiar susceptibility to falsehoods and illusions. It's a huge swing.
How does he even structure a 500-year argument like that? What's the thread he follows to show this like national tendency towards delusion?
Well, he identifies these recurring cultural habits that he argues make America distinct. It starts, he says, with those early utopian dreams, because the idea that America was this blank slate, almost a new Eden, where the old rules didn't apply and you could create instant perfection.
Linking it back to the Puritans and the frontier.
Exactly. 17th century religious zealotry, the whole frontier mentality where you could just ditch reality and start over. He sees these as foundational.
So it's a historical line running through religious extremism, get-rich-quick schemes, maybe anti-intellectualism, rejecting established facts.
Pretty much. He points to things like the explosion of spiritualism in the 19th century, the era of big P.T. Barnum-style hoaxes, this persistent American belief in secret knowledge or shortcuts to enlightenment or wealth. He sees all these as examples of a culture conditioned to suspend disbelief easily.
And then he connects that long history directly to C.
Right. He draws a line from that historical susceptibility to the modern media landscape, cable news echo chambers, the way conspiracy theories spread online, and ultimately the political success of figures who promise radical reality-bending solutions.
So the argument is basically, the current weirdness isn't new or an accident. It's the culmination of centuries of ingrained cultural habits. Powerful stuff.
And it landed with impact. It hit number 3 on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. The Times Book Review called it a great revisionist history of America.
Okay, so if Fantasyland is about the cultural mindset, the collective psychology, what about the follow-up?
All right, 3 years later, 2020, he publishes Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, a recent history. This is the structural critique. He even called it a companion to Fantasyland.
And more bluntly.
And, yeah, he also called it a de facto volume 2 in My History of the Fucking of America. So pretty clear where he stands.
Okay, Evil Geniuses. The time frame shifts dramatically here, right? Not 500 years, but mainly 1970s to 2020. Why that focus?
That shift is key. Fantasyland was about deep cultural roots. Evil Geniuses is about arguably more recent deliberate actions. The book argues that starting around the early 1970s, specific groups, intellectuals, political operatives, business leaders, began really coordinated efforts to reshape America's economy and politics along conservative lines.
So he's not saying it's some secret conspiracy necessarily.
No, not like a hidden cabal, more like an observable decades-long campaign pushed through think tanks, lobbying, political strategy, judicial appointments, a concerted effort to shift the rules of the game.
So, if Fantasyland explains why people might be susceptible to certain ideas or promises, Evil Geniuses explains who might have systematically taken advantage of that, or at least implemented policies that had certain effects, by redesigning the economic system.
That seems to be the connection he's making. The book argues these coordinated efforts promoted what he calls an unfettered laissez-faire approach to capitalism.
Meaning deregulation, weakening unions, tax cuts favoring the wealthy, that sort of thing. Dismantling the New Deal framework.
Exactly. And the book's thesis concludes that this systematic, decades-long shift is directly responsible for the extreme level of economic inequality and disempowered majority that he argues characterizes America today.
So the takeaway is pretty stark. The vast inequality we see isn't just like the natural outcome of free markets. He's arguing it's the result of specific, deliberate policy choices made over a long period.
That's the core contention. It's a structural argument that really complements his earlier work and probably reflects lessons learned from experiences like that clash at New York Magazine.
And we should probably note, he was thinking about these economic issues earlier, too. He wrote an essay called Reset back in 2009.
Right. Analyzing the causes and effects of the Great Recession. So this critique of economic instability and inequality has been part of his focus for well over a decade. And just when you think you have him pegged as the serious historian, he pivots again. His work finds yet another new medium, maybe the most surprising one yet.
Right. Satirical, scripted science fiction. Which brings us to Command Z, his collaboration with Steven Soderbergh.
It's kind of wild, isn't it? From deep historical analysis to working with one of the most respected film directors on a genre TV series, it really shows how far his ideas reach.
And this came about because Soderbergh read Evil Geniuses and reached out.
That's the story. Soderbergh initiated the conversation after reading the book.
So what is Command Z? Soderbergh directed all 8 episodes, stars Michael Cera, Liev Schreiber, Roy Wood Jr.
The premise is basically a satirical take on Anderson's structural critique from Evil Geniuses. It uses this sci-fi setup, the ability to subtly alter the past, to explore whether America's current problems could be fixed if key historical moments were tweaked. It's like applying the book's diagnosis in a fictional, slightly absurd way.
The fact that someone like Soderbergh is looking to Anderson's nonfiction for creative inspiration, that really cements Anderson's status as a kind of foundational thinker about modern America.
It does. And there's that interesting philanthropic angle, too, the whole Command Z project, released in 2023, donated all its proceeds to charity.
Which reinforces the idea that his later work seems driven more by a desire for societal impact or correction, maybe, than just commercial success.
I think that's fair to say. So if you try to synthesize this whole journey,
yeah.
It's quite remarkable. From that sharp, almost two-dimensional caricature of the short-fingered vulgarian back-end spy.
To the massive 500-year historical sweep of Fantasyland.
The connecting thread seems pretty clear, doesn't it? His entire career feels like one long, sustained effort to analyze the core beliefs, the illusions, and the underlying structural forces that shape American culture and politics.
He mastered print early on, then adapted to the long-form intimacy of audio, and now he's moving into visual digital media, always picking the format that fits the analysis he wants to do.
It's like he started out using satire to diagnose the surface symptoms of American excess in the 80s.
And then matured into a historian using deep, patient research to diagnose the systemic disease, tracing its origins way back.
Yeah. He still lives in New York City with his wife, the author Ann Creamer. They have two daughters. But his public legacy is really built on the sheer volume, the intellectual consistency, and the unflinching nature of his critique across all these different forms.
His real strength, it seems, is using that deep knowledge, historical, cultural, to explain why things feel the way they do right now in America, why it feels so chaotic, so divided.
He gives you, the reader or listener, a kind of historical map. He's arguing that the confusion isn't just random noise. It's, in many ways, constructed. It has roots.
So we've walked through how Kurt Anderson makes this case that many of our current crises, whether it's political polarization or economic inequality, they stem from either these deep, centuries-old cultural habits he outlines in Fantasyland.
Or from the specific coordinated structural changes, particularly from the 1970s onward, that he details in Evil Geniuses.
Which really reframes the whole challenge, doesn't it? If the reality you see around you today isn't just an accident, not just things going randomly wrong, but is actually the result of decades, maybe centuries, of design or deeply ingrained cultural habit.
Then fixing it requires more than just tweaking policies here and there. It suggests a much deeper intervention might be needed.
And that brings us to a final provocative thought for you, the listener. Thinking about Anderson's own career, how he constantly pivoted between media formats depending on his goal, using satire for exposure, fiction maybe for empathy, history for structural understanding.
It makes you wonder, which of these tools, which of his methods of critique do you think is actually the most effective for charting a path towards, well, remaking America, if that's the goal? Is it the sharp, sometimes brutal honesty of satire? Is it the power of compelling narrative and storytelling? Or is it the rigorous, sweeping historical analysis that lays bare the deep structures? Which approach really moves the needle?